grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. Tonight on the show, I am so very excited to have futurist Gray Scott with us. He explores emerging technologies as a techno-philosopher, talks about AI, self-aware machines, ever-popular sex robots that we're always talking about on our Facebook page, all kinds of stuff. Before we welcome Gray to the show, don't forget, Dudes and Beer is now brought to you by Audible. Make sure to stop on by audibletrial.com/dudes to get your 30-day free trial of Amazon's Audible. You'll get some great audiobooks there. If you don't like the book, you can trade it in, get a different book. It's a great system. I love it. I use it on the road because I just don't have time to sit down and read anymore. And that's some of the stuff that we will be talking about tonight with our guest. Our guest is a futurist. Gray Scott is also the host of Futuristic Now, a great web series that really talks about a lot of stuff. I've been following him for a little while on social media, things like that. I'm very excited to have him on. Here's a little clip from his deepfake AI episode that came out just a few days ago.
For the next level. So the AI has, you know, AI that can manipulate videos and voices, that's been around for a little while. So we're already in that. We've already crossed that threshold into a new realm of digital reality. Okay. Futurists have been talking about this for a very long time. You know, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, Alvin Toffler, Buckminster Fuller, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, all of these futurists were talking about this. They knew it was coming.
Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Gray Scott, how are you doing today, Gray?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, I've been following you for a little while. I want to say it was a History Channel show that I saw you on. About transhumanism or something like that. And I was like, oh, I love what this guy has to say. Cause you literally just break it down into the most common sense terms and really come at it from an ethical philosophy point of view, not just the fact of, hey, this is technology. It exists, but man, what are we supposed to do with this? How are we supposed to treat it? You know, and how are we supposed to go into the future with this knowledge? So take it away. Let us know how you got into being a futurist and how you started producing the show Futuristic Now.
So I began my career as a futurist by attending the World Future Society conference in Toronto. And that was about 5 or 6 years ago, almost 7 years ago. And I'd never even heard of the World Future Society, and I didn't even know that being a futurist was an actual job that you could do. I mean, I had heard of Buckminster Fuller, obviously, and sure. I knew of all of these science fiction writers, people I just mentioned, Arthur C. Clarke, Isaac Asimov, things like that. But I wasn't aware that you could actually make a living as a futurist. And so I went to the World Future Society and I took a futures writing class. I started writing for the Futures magazine, got published there several times. And the first thing I did was I started to realize that there was a space in that field that no one had really filled. There was a space there for someone to talk about the philosophy of technology. And not just be a technologist. So when I tell people that I'm a futurist, you have to understand what that really means. There are foresight experts, people who work with corporations and help them predict where business is going to go. And I do some of that myself. I mean, I speak at conferences I consult with companies all over the world. But my primary work is to be on television, whether that's on the news or that's on Discovery or History Channel or Nat Geo or any of those channels. And my job right now is to speak to the public, because Isaac Asimov said one time in an interview, this is really interesting, he said, we cannot leave it to the academics and the corporations to make the decisions for our future. We have to be involved. And so my primary mission right now is to, first of all, get more people to become futurists, because we need more, of all different categories. We need more women futurists. We need futurists in different parts of the world, not just the United States. And we need different types of futurists that are working with corporations, but also futurists to start programs in elementary schools, to get kids to start thinking about the future in the way that only futurists could talk about it. So that's been my primary goal. And the thing that's funny is that the first thing I did after I decided to make this my career, after I left the World Future Society and I was writing for about 2 to 3 months, I decided to put out a video on YouTube. I started my YouTube channel. And the first video that I ever made was, I think it was called Dream Recording. And it was based off of a white paper that came out of the University of Kyoto. And it was based on their research on taking test subjects, hooking them up to EEG headsets or fMRI systems where they could read their brain waves. They would show them an image, a very crude black and white, like a square or a circle, and they could output that onto a computer screen. That was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And I knew the moment I saw this and I read this research that we were headed towards being able to read and output images from what we were seeing inside of our minds. We would eventually output that. And so I was extrapolating and I said, you know, the future really is leading us towards being able to record our dreams. So I made this video, very simple 3-minute video. I talked about the research. I talked about sort of extrapolations and, you know, why this would happen and that there would be a dream recording social network and all the things that came around the idea of dream recording. And then it was maybe 2 weeks later, I was hosting a week long show on Discovery Channel. So this whole thing had happened so quickly to me that, I really barely had time to sort of formulate my ideas and my theories around futurism itself. And I think you have to have a very strong sense of philosophy, your own personal philosophy. You have to have a very strong sense and understanding of reality outside of the cultural, crap that we're sort of fed all the time. You know, Terrence McKenna talked about this all the time. He used to say that culture is not your friend. And I am a real believer in that. I think we, as futurists, are part of our job also, too, is to say what we've been taught is not necessarily the full truth. Yeah. The full truth is cosmic. It's not just cultural. And so that's how this whole thing began.
Yeah, and the work that you've been doing, the message that you've been putting out is so absolutely amazing, and like I said before the show, so necessary. Such a breath of fresh air to hear somebody calling to question how we go about stepping into the future. Because, yeah, right now we are straddling the gap. We are right up against the predictions of our science fiction forefathers.
Absolutely.
I mean that beyond the Star Trek universe, folks. I mean, like, people back in the 30s who wrote, talking about robotics, talking about AI, learning machines, things like that. Your video that you recently put out that we were playing a minute ago for deepfake AI. A lot of that technology emerged years ago. Where there was utter replacement technology that could be used in film, that kind of stuff. Go into some of that a little bit, and what the implications of some of these things like deepfake AI video could be.
Well, just briefly, for the listeners, I have to explain what deepfake actually is.
So please.
Basically, what we're able to do now is we're able to take still photographs, which is miraculous, that we could take a still photograph or we could take clips of short videos and use AI to manipulate the facial structures and manipulate the voice to replicate and create new images and new videos that enable filmmakers to make videos of anyone saying anything at any time. That's a profound, profound shift in what we call reality. So it's not just Photoshop anymore. These are moving images with voice. So this is the ability to be able to make a video of you or your listeners and make it say anything that they want you to say. Now, here's the thing that's interesting. So deepfake has been around for a little while. The most famous cases are deepfakes of Obama and deepfake videos of Putin. And those are easy enough to find on YouTube. But what's happened recently is that you're starting to see small little deepfakes being made of celebrities. The most recent deepfakes were, I think it was released this month, of Mark Zuckerberg and Kim Kardashian.
Yeah.
And the videos are pretty detrimental to their brand because they're saying things that they normally wouldn't say publicly. And this is what I'd been talking about this 4 or 5 years ago, that we would sort of shift away from the reality that we know into sort of a hyper reality, a sort of digitized reality. And deep fakes are just the beginning of the slippery slope that we're headed towards. The next level to this is the ability to manipulate any image from any clip, even if it's a still image, even if you have just a still image of your face. We are going to get to the place where we can take a still image and a tiny clip of your voice and make a complete video out of that. Making you say anything that the creator wants to say. Now, this gets into a very gray area because the person that did the Mark Zuckerberg deepfake video is an artist. Now we're getting into the stage of saying, well, what is art? Is this an art form? Because if it is, then it's protected under free speech. So we're looking at a really weird thing where it's not just a painter painting someone's portrait. This is a digital artist creating a whole new persona based on the face and the voice. So
interesting.
In this recent video on Futuristic Now, I was extrapolating into the future of where this is going to take us. And I'll just give you a couple of sort of weird scenarios that could play out here. One is that you're going to need to have digital persona insurance. There are going to be insurance companies that are going to form that you will need to take out a policy to protect yourself against digital identity manipulation. Meaning that if you're a CEO of a company and someone decided to take down your company, if they decided to destroy your company, they can just take a clip of you and make you say something horrible and put it out on social media. You would need insurance to cover if anything happened. If your stock fell, if you lost your company. This is not just for CEOs though. This is not just for celebrities. This is going to happen to each of us and it's going to happen to our children because that gets really scary when you start talking about families not being able to protect their children's digital personas, their digital identities.
Yep.
And think about all of the families that have put their children on Facebook from the day they were born until their graduation. Think about that.
Yeah. And, you know, we actually used to have a guest on fairly regularly for a while who was a former Secret Service fraud investigator and now heads up the UT Center for Identity, things like that. And America is actually one of the only countries that has no actual law concerning what a digital identity is. Right now, it's the Wild West. You can literally do whatever. And that's pretty frightening in and of itself, much less like, when will we get to the point of a digital age of consent? Where like my 2-year-old child, we posted pictures of him online, his biometric data is out there. We cannot take that back. We made that decision on his behalf.
Yeah, and wait till the children, when teenagers start suing their parents.
Yeah.
Because their digital persona has been hacked and their life is basically ruined because their parents decided to record everything. And the hackers were able to use that. So we're really in this weird transitional stage. This metamorphosis, this digital metamorphosis is happening to us right now. So, you know, for a very long time, I talked about how technology was this sort of second skin that has been here the whole time. There's a lot of theories about what technology actually is. I have my own theory. I've been saying for a very long time that technology is natural and that nature is technological. And so there is no man versus machine. Or humanity versus machine. It is all the same thing. It's a continuum. And so when you think of it like that, you can actually start to address the core of the real issue. The real issue is not technology. It never has been. The wheel is just a round stone until someone puts it together and decides to take that somewhere. Fire can either heat your house or burn your house down, right?
Yeah.
So it is the intention and it is the, I guess intention is the best way to describe this. It is the intention behind the tool that is the real problem. So it's not the AI that's the problem here. We could be using all of these technologies to benefit and help each other, but we're pulling the really negative antiquated cultural baggage with us on this journey into the future. And we need to let some of that go. Some of the stuff that just doesn't work anymore. So, I mean, and this gets us into the idea of abundance. This gets us into the idea of universal basic income. This gets us into the idea of if everything gets automated, then what's the point of working? What's human purpose? So you can see very quickly, you know, we can start talking about deepfake and then suddenly we're opening up this philosophical idea of like, what is technology? What is the purpose of technology? Yeah.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, we've gotten to a point almost where technology defines us now. And when you were talking just a second ago, I said I do corporate AV for a living. So I'm sitting in on meetings all the time. And when I heard an economist the other day, talking to a group of CEOs about automated driving. And he's like, you know, everybody's worried about how it's going to take truck driving jobs away. Do you think that we would be coming up with automated 18-wheelers if we had an influx of 18-wheeler drivers?
Yeah.
He was like, the problem is our shipping needs exceed the people who are actually willing to drive trucks. But we still have to be able to meet those needs. So that's why we're investing the money in automation, not to take jobs away from people. We'd gladly give them to them if they wanted them.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. See, the problem is that we don't really. Okay, let me try to back up here.
Go ahead. So
the first thing to understand is that we are operating on a cultural operating system. That is what we operate from. And most of us operate in a cultural operating system that is about 35 years, That's the range of the average person. They can get their head around about 35 years of cultural operating system, meaning that they understand about 35 years of culture. Okay.
Okay.
They have there's even a smaller amount that they can remember. So we're talking the average cultural memory is about 7, maybe even 5 years. People forget really quickly things that have happened.
Yes.
So if you start from that place and you understand that whenever you're dealing with people, you're also dealing with a very limited sliver of the cultural operating system. One of the biggest jobs for a futurist is to get people in the mindset of thinking cosmically and not culturally. So when you say to somebody, and I love to do this sometimes when I'm speaking at crowds, I like to say, you know, where are we? Where are we right now? And the average person says, oh, we're in a convention center, or we're in Houston, we're in Dallas, we're in Texas, we're in whatever. And I always think no one ever says we're floating on a piece of dust in the cosmos. That's not the operating system that they're running. Their cultural operating system is localized.
Yeah.
And it's a very small sliver of perception. So what I'm saying to people is, if you start to open up your perception cosmically, you're going to start to see very differently. You're going to start thinking differently, and you're going to start seeing some of these patterns that hide within nature, within the cosmos. You're going to start seeing those patterns. What's happening to us right now has happened to other species. It's happened to us before. I mean, there were periods where we transitioned from the oceans to the land, to cities. I mean, we have evolved as a species, as an organism on this planet. So
yeah.
When you start thinking like that, it pulls you away from being so myopic and thinking so small when it comes to the idea of technology. Only when you get to that place can you start to really understand what some of the real intentions are for technology and from technology. So I've never bought into the idea that there's like a small group of people pulling the strings. First of all, we're not there. Yes, there are cabals of people trying to make things happen. There always
sure.
have been. But human beings are not smart enough, nor are we advanced enough to make this kind of thing that's happening play out as smoothly as it's playing out. I think that it is some sort of directional intention that the cosmos naturally has. And a lot of people have talked about the great filter, meaning that the reason we don't find, you know, or we haven't seen a lot of alien life out in the cosmos is because the sort of immune system of the cosmos is technology, and that technology is the filter that keeps biological, intellectual creatures from taking over the cosmos. I mean, think of it. If there wasn't some sort of immune system, if there wasn't something, some sort of filter that kept us in check, I mean, we have plans to get off this planet and to colonize a new planet. I mean, if that continues, we could take over the cosmos, especially
yeah.
if we become transhuman and we start, you know, altering our minds with AI.
Well, and, you know, even here recently with the spaceman stunt, you know, where they launched the vehicle out with the spaceman. It was one of those, like, did y'all assemble that in a clean room? Just curious before you send a meteor with Earth germs hurtling through space irresponsibly. You know,
yeah.
Like, that's horrifying. What not only did you just throw another piece of space junk out there, but now it's got a projectile trajectory, and it's polluted with Earth germs. Great. How horribly irresponsible. And that's what you were saying earlier, the lack of forethought. The lack of not thinking about that, the foresight of, oh, wow. Yeah. What if that does hit somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we do have to think about that, the good, the bad concept, where technology is going, and how do we ethically use the technology at our fingertips? One of the guys that I love having on this show is from the Radical Empathy Foundation, and they actually use VR to teach people about human trafficking. Because it's a way to immerse somebody in an experience. And it's pretty powerful. It's really wild. But you know, to know that applications of technology like that are there, where you can alter somebody's perception of reality for a short time, and have it impact them. You have to be responsible in how you do that.
You do. I mean, this is something a lot of futurists have been talking about recently, is the ethical impact and the ethical standards of creating these technologies. But the problem is that I don't think we're not in control of it. We haven't been. We've never been in control of it. So we're under this assumption that we are the creators of this technology.
Yeah.
And if you follow the thread of what I laid down earlier, saying that nature is technological, that means that anything that emerges from the cosmos is technological. So there is no difference between you and the computer you're sitting in front of. As abstract and as philosophical as that sounds, it's actually very, very tangible and true, because
yes,
every element that's in that computer is also in your body. We have very similar elements throughout nature that are in the computer. So it's just I go back to this idea of the intention and why the cosmos has evolved the way that it's evolved. One of the things that I've been talking about is that there is a future in front of us. Physicists have been debating whether the future actually already exists, because there is a theory that the past, present, and future have already happened, that everything has already happened and we're just moving through this timeline.
Huh.
I'm a proponent of that. I actually think that that is true. There's a lot of reasons why I think that's true. First of all, because the cosmos itself seems to be algorithmic. It seems to be geometric at its core. You know, our bodies are geometric if you look down to the molecular level. Nature is geometric. There are codes and patterns throughout nature. Nature is an algorithm. I mean, that is literally what it is. And the reason we see it the way we see it is because we don't see the molecular level. We see the higher state of that geometric base. So if you extrapolate from there, then what that means is there is a long algorithm and a long code that has been going on for a very long time. Now, to say that you're not connected to that algorithm and that you can step outside of that stream of geometry and math is literally impossible. There's no way for us to do that, because everything in our body, your DNA is made up of millions and millions and billions even of years of cosmic evolution.
Yeah.
So when they say we are stardust, well, that's true, but we're also math. We're also geometry. And so anything that emerges from the cosmos is technological. That means we are technological. It means that our computers, our smartphones, all these gadgets that are being created, these are our cousins. I know that sounds so weird for me to say, but these objects, we are related to these objects. And so to say that we are the creators of these objects is an awfully egotistical thing to think, that we came up with this.
Yeah.
Now, in fact, the truth is, just like Einstein, just like Feynman, just like any other physicist, any physicist that has looked into nature, they begin to see these patterns and codes, and that's what becomes these formulas that become the base of creating these new, or quote unquote, new objects. This is why I say the future is a portal inward, and what we're going to find there is ancient and computational. We're headed towards discovering the ultimate reality, not altering reality. We're actually we're waking up into the hyper-reality. Think about this. We only see a very, very small sliver of the light spectrum. We only hear a very, very small sliver of the audible world. So when you say to someone, what is reality? What you're asking them is, what is the small piece of reality that you can see? Tell me about that. Ultimate reality is much more complex, and we don't even know what it is yet.
Yeah, and right now we're trying to figure out if reality is even real. I mean, you can get down to the absolute physics of whether or not you're actively touching a table, or whether or not that's just electron field repulsion.
Exactly.
And things repelling off of each other. Right now we're across the country from each other, but we're technically sharing an electron shell. You know, so yeah, when you're saying that this is all a part of us, that this is all a part of nature. Absolutely. Absolutely. Like you cannot separate those things.
So here's my question for your audience too. The real question we should be asking ourselves, and this is very hard to do because, as I said before, we're running the cultural operating system. Most people are. And I do it too. I mean, you know, I get into my routine. I go to the grocery store. I go to the gym. Those are cultural operating system moments. They pull us out of the cosmic thinking. And so what I'm interested in is, and this is the question for your audience, is where are we headed? What is the future going to be like? There are clues. I call them cultural echoes that I believe are sort of echoes bouncing back from the future to sort of engage with us. And this is a deep physics conversation if we could go into that. But the idea here is that we, in a way, are communicating with the past, and we're communicating with the future at all times. If that is true, and there's some evidence that is true, that we already know where we're headed, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So it's why sometimes when people like Steve Jobs create these groundbreaking technologies, or Elon Musk, there's a sense of sort of destiny that's built into that. And I think that has to do with this algorithm that I was talking about, that there is an ultimate reason why all of this is happening. Now, here's what's going to really sort of cook your noodle, as they say. there are several reasons and sort of theories that I've been thinking about why technology has always been here and where we're headed with this whole thing. One, that the ultimate ending to this show is simulation, okay? And a lot of people have been talking about this. It's not just the Matrix. This is something that's been going on. This has actually been talked about in philosophy from the very beginning of time.
Yeah.
The idea of reality and sort of a simulated reality. That's one thing. We could be headed towards a simulation at the end of time, a black hole, so to speak. I've been calling it the simulated singularity, meaning that as reality becomes simulated, it also crunches down into a sort of singularity state. I mean, if you can get your head around what I just said, you're way ahead of everybody else. Second, this could be, as I said before, this technology could be the built-in immune system for the cosmos. The cosmos may have technology may be its immune system, where it says, okay, I will allow a species to get to a certain stage, but if it looks like they're going to destroy a planet, or if it looks like they're going to leave their home planet, or if they get out of control and mutate, then this will be the immune system and it will take them out. And there's a lot of evidence that this is how it may end for us, whether it's nuclear bombs or whether it's the environment and climate change. A lot of evidence that this may be a filter that we can't get past. That's number two. And then number three is that it's not that we're headed towards the simulation. It is that we're already in the simulation. Now that is really where it gets complicated. There's a lot of things we could go into here, and I just want to explain quickly.
Please.
If an AI in the year 2019 can already see your brain's images that it's creating, if in 2019 the AI can already manipulate your image and make you say things and simulate you into a video, so that's what we're already doing in 2019. Think about the year 2050 and how things are exponentially growing so quickly. Think about what the world will be like in 2050. Do you really think that an AI, whether that's nanobot material that you breathe in, whether that's an injection that you take or a brain implant, or who the hell knows how that's going to unfold, but do we really think that we would remember and notice an AI manipulating our memory? It could manipulate our memory in a way that we wouldn't remember the transition into the simulation.
Yeah.
So suddenly, I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? It's like,
absolutely.
Suddenly you've slipped, our society and our world has slipped into the simulation, and we don't even notice because the AI has erased the transition moment. So has that already happened to us? And here's where it's very dangerous psychologically for people. You have to have as a futurist and a philosopher, you have to have a very strong sense of self and a strong sense of psychological stability.
Yes.
To even contemplate this stuff, because you can sound crazy and you can come off schizophrenic, but I'm very clear with myself that until I see absolute proof of some of these things, that these are just questions, these are just theories at this point for me. The only proof that we have right now is that we are actually accomplishing the ability to simulate reality in a way that's believable. That is the proof. That's actually what's pushing me more towards the idea that this may already be the simulation. But there is, the question is, how would you prove that?
Yeah. It would be hard, and if you did prove it, would it basically not only collapse society but people's minds?
Would it collapse the simulation?
Yeah. Yeah.
You think about that. Would it, you know, I someone said to me,
well, because the simulation requires our active participation.
Well, it requires it requires the subject inside of the simulation to not necessarily know that they're in the simulation.
See, yeah.
The gig is up now. The gig is up. So what's happened is that once we started having the conversation about simulation within society, and once the masses started to really wake up the simulation idea, suddenly the potential for the simulated system to start crashing is a real possibility. Well, look what's happening. We're headed towards complete chaos with this thing that we call technology. And so maybe this is how, you know, maybe this is how it sort of plays out, is that, okay, it took 2019 years for the species to figure out that, or it took, you know, 6,500,000 years for this species to figure out that it was being simulated. And maybe that was the simulation that was being run, was how long does it take for us to figure it out? How does this help people? I don't know. I mean, you know, there are often times where I say, I don't want to talk about the simulation theory anymore because it just confuses people. But then when you start talking about deep fake technologies and how that confuses people, how could you not talk about the idea of reality and simulation and
yeah,
the end of time and yeah.
Well, and the thing is, whenever some of us started talking about this stuff years ago, like whenever Adobe first came out with the new software that lets you, with 20 minutes of hearing somebody, it can mimic their voice completely. Any text mm-hmm. you type in, it'll say it. I could literally feed in a transcript of an episode and it would be me talking the way I talk, inflections and all. And with that kind of AI, that was like 3 years ago that they announced it. So that means that they were working on it hardcore for a few years before that.
Absolutely.
None of this stuff is new. And that's what we really have to consider is that, if Lord forfend, if people are using things for nefarious means, they've already been using them, for nefarious yeah. means. So they're like way ahead of the curve, as far as that goes. But for the technology of convincible video, the deep fake video that came out of Zuckerberg, that kind of stuff, where it is like, wow, that's some pretty intense, really well done video. And that's becoming so entirely commonplace now. Like where do you see things going with things like that in the next few years? How do you think that will impact our society? I mean, right now we've seen the impact of social media, leading to doxing, all kinds of stuff. And even that where people have jumped the gun, ruined people's lives, all kinds of stuff. We are prone to this hysteria, with this kind of thing. So, what do you think might be the outcome of some of this over the next couple of years? What kind of things do you think we might be seeing?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that we are a visual species. And so we tend to believe what we see. So that's going to be a major problem for people. But you have to also remember that we are not necessarily vigilant when we address things that we do see. So in other words, what I'm saying is that it's very easy for subliminal visual messages to get into our system. Advertisers have known this for years. There's a whole study on how to manipulate people in advertising. So we've known that for a very long time. Now see, the problem that gets compounded here is when you start plugging that sort of nefarious mind altering state, into the digital AI system that is even more subtle and more cued to your brainwaves, literally your brainwaves. And that's sort of where this thing is headed. When here's the thing. We're moving away from the phones and we're moving into smart glasses. The minute that Apple releases a smart glass that doesn't look like a cyborg, that just looks like a pair of glasses that the mass public will adopt, that's when things are going to start to really rapidly change, because suddenly there's an augmented filter that is going to be on your face that separates your reality from the hyper reality that these glasses are going to be showing you. In other words, augmented reality is going to be able to place an overlay on top of your world. And I'll explain this in a way that this is just one simple application that you could have on your phone. I live in New England, so our winters are long and cold. I have a place in New York, so we can talk about 6 months of brutal winter cold. When you're in the country, no leaves, there's snow on the ground. So let's say there's an application and it's a seasonal application and it's an AR application. You're wearing your smart glasses and you decide, I don't want to look at this winter scene anymore. I want it to be summer. Well, over the summer, the glasses were continually scanning out every window in your house. It was scanning when you walked around the property. It was scanning the trees and the grass and the birds and the butterflies and the bees. And then suddenly you decide, okay, in the middle of winter, I'd like to see summer again. You open up the application, and then every time you look out the window or when you walk outside, you're not seeing winter anymore. You're seeing summer. There's an overlay, and that overlay is so hyper-realistic that you would never know. I mean, we're not talking about Pokemon here. We're talking about epic hyper-realism.
Yeah.
So that when you looked outside, you thought it was summer. That's just one of hundreds and hundreds of applications that could alter what we think we're seeing in the near future. We're not even getting into advertising, perceptual influence,
yep.
being able to hack someone's smart glasses and make them see Nike everywhere.
Ooh.
If Nike decided, think about any company
yeah.
that wanted to hack into those systems, or not even hack, any of those companies that wanted to pay a premium price for 10 minutes on everybody's smart glasses.
Oh, yeah,
suddenly,
absolutely.
No matter.
At a live event.
Everywhere you go, there's Nike.
You could walk into the basketball game and you got to watch a Pepsi commercial on your smart glasses before the game starts.
It's already there.
And
if you watch hockey right now, when you're watching the hockey games, there are signs, quote unquote, placed on the glass that are not real advertisements. They're not there in real life.
Yeah.
But you don't know that because it's an augmented part of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, I mean, you can just see if you extrapolate how that's going to change us.
Well, and this is one of my, people say I have a conspiratorial mindset. Imagine that. I choose to see things in a fractal point of view. And the fact of there are trends, things repeat themselves. I spent years studying subliminal psychology, like as a hobby. I loved it. It fascinated me, you know, all the books about the subliminal advertising that was done back in the day. And the laws that were passed against it. And to go into, the fact of brain entrainment, the fact that if you expose your brain to a certain frequency regularly, that it will readily produce that frequency. That's what makes you tired, folks. Whenever you watch TV, is that your brain is literally starting to think at that rate. It's because the TV is flashing that many times per second. So we went from 30 hertz to 60 up to 120 and beyond now. So you now have 4 or 5 times as many opportunities to put in a flash frame of subliminal message. And you can now entrain somebody's brain with a message like that 5 times faster, because of the resolution of television screens, things like that. That's my nefarious, fractal mentality thinking about that. But, even whenever you were talking about the dream technology earlier, the first thing I thought was, my God, I could swear that I remember a sci-fi movie where, like, you had advertising in your dreams. Where?
Oh, yeah, that's the easiest part to do. I think the easiest part is for them to get the advertising in there.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, here's the thing. I mean, we have a couple of technologies that are really beneficial and really helpful to us. If we could get those technologies in place, we could stop some of this darker technology from taking over. So, for example, blockchain is a perfect example of this. So if we were to move all of our social media and all of our social media content, our digital personas, over to a blockchain system, if any alteration happens to our digital persona, everyone would see the alteration. If that makes sense. So,
sure.
So you can't change one of the records without everyone in the system seeing that there was a change made. And that would tell people. So for example, if a video came out of us saying something we would never say and it was on the blockchain system, all people would have to do is go check our individual
blockchain
yeah. and they would see that an alteration had happened. That's just one small piece of how this could go right if we do it the right way. The other part of this is automation. If we get to a place where machines do everything, and I mean literally everything, they're only machines in factories, they're only machines doing the hard labor, there is no choice economically. And there is no economist that wants to talk about this. And I said this, I spoke at the London Business School, and I stood on that stage and I said, there may be a future where there is no money. And you would not believe the reaction I got from that crowd. People could not believe I said it.
Oh, yeah.
Because, no economist wants to talk about this. You cannot automate every job away without the prices falling to near zero of products. There is no way. But besides, what's the point? What's the point of charging someone a premium price for something if there are no employees, if there are no commercial spaces for your employees to be at work?
Yeah.
So all you have is your factory and the materials to build the robots. And if the robots are building the other robots, you don't even need people to build the other robots.
Yeah, shouldn't the products then be cheaper?
Well, Larry Page from Google said this. He said, yes, the robots are going to take your job, but everything's going to get cheaper. There's no way that it can't. Because, first of all, the businesses, they would go out of business. Let me put it to you this way. This is a very simple toaster analogy. You have a factory, and your factory makes toasters, okay?
Okay.
If you automate, and there are 1,000 employees, if you automate all 1,000 of those employees and you take away 1,000 jobs, so suddenly there's only machines making toasters, but the machines are making them 10 times faster and 10 times more efficient with 10 times less material. So there's a dematerialization happening, which is a field of what's going on in the material world too. We're using less material to make the same product. If you can do that, then suddenly you've put that community out of work, so they don't have the money to buy your toaster anymore. What's your choice? You either lower the price to a place where they can afford it so that they will actually buy them from you, or you lose your company. It's a very simple formula here. There's no way that we can still charge the same price for materials if everyone is out of work.
Yeah.
Now, people will say, well, we're going to have, you know, it's not that jobs are going away. We're just going to be doing different jobs. Well, there is no job. I mean, art, people say, oh, machines will never, that's not true.
Yeah.
Robots can paint. They can paint already. So that's out the window.
They can write music. They can sing.
Right. Yes. They can do.
Creepily, no, but they job. Can do it.
Yeah. There's no job that these machines will not be able to do in the future.
Yeah.
Period. None. People say, oh, psychology, forget it. That you can feed every psychology and every philosophy book into a computer and to an AI, and it can become the greatest philosopher known to man. Trust me, all that's going to happen.
Yeah.
There's no job that a machine can't do. So here's our choice in the future. There may be supplemental jobs, meaning that, you know, okay, so maybe we become coders for this new line of automation. This new world of automation. Okay. So maybe we become the maintenance people for the machines themselves, whatever that is. But there won't be enough of that work to go around for 7 billion or 8 billion people. Okay.
Yeah.
So what we have to see here is that the economy is going to shift in ways that we can hardly even imagine. And I don't mean a collapse. I just mean that there has to be a shift in thinking from the corporations, because they're going to go out of business.
Yeah.
And there's going to be catastrophic ramifications if they don't change the way they think about how they do this. See, I think that eventually we're going to get to a place where our basic needs are taken care of. So housing, food, clothing, all that can be automated. I mean, and when I say automated, I mean, there are farm bots that are in the fields right now.
Sure.
There are 3D printers that can print 3D clothing. There are 3D printers that can print housing from sand and concrete. So we're going to get to a place, hopefully, where everything is automated. And then what we're going to be left with is trying to figure out what our purpose is, and also struggling with this new sense of digital reality.
Yeah, and it's odd to be at this point. I guess I'm 44 years old, and I remember very vividly the computers that I had as a child when I was in late elementary, early junior high, things like that. And just to distill it, folks, most of what we call technology is only a couple hundred years old. Science itself is only a few hundred years old.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're talking about the scope of humanity and where we have come to and the point that we've come to so rapidly, a lot of it is a leap before you look. Because if you just, I mean, one of the craziest things I heard in a presentation this last year at the NVIDIA conference, was somebody from Lockheed Martin saying that we are very well looking at the fact that Moore's law will be obsolete within the next 3 years.
Yep.
The calculation that we have used to base computing on and how fast it grows and how fast markets grow, like, we're about to surpass that. And that's been what we've known as computer science for 50, 60 years. And then to see another person from MIT give a presentation at a different conference, where two AIs were talking to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And had you not known, had she not told you afterward that they were AIs, you'd have thought that you just heard a customer service phone call.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was wild. I see these things regularly, and man, just to know where technology is now and to think about the implications, think about the ramifications, you know, even automated vehicles, like we don't even know who's at fault in an accident with one yet. You know, so we tend to leap before we look regularly as a society. And like you said earlier, we have a very, very short attention span. It's about 7 years. And beyond that, we're like goldfish. We don't remember if we ate or not. So it's so great to know that people like you are out there as a modern philosopher, taking on the technological issues of society, trying to get people to think, like you said, more in a cosmic mentality, get out of the cultural mentality, and start looking beyond, and start thinking that way so that we can, move together forward as a society, as a humanity as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on this evening, Gray. I'm gonna go ahead and let you go. I know you are an hour ahead of us here in Central, but tell everybody where they can go to find Futuristic Now, any books, upcoming speaking events, things like that that you may have going on, Gray.
Yeah, so I have a YouTube channel called Futuristic Now, and you can find it by going to YouTube/GrayScottFuture. And there you can find every video that I've made. There are a couple of lectures. I think the London Business School is on there as well. I'm not sure. But you can also go to grayscott.com, and that's where you can find everything. Everything is sort of central to there. All the press that I've done, the television shows I've been on, and all, you know, most of my quotes. Primarily my thing right now is just to keep talking to the public. And there's a couple of things coming up, hopefully, that one of them is a book chapter in a new book that's coming out at the end of this year. It's called Aftershock. It's a follow-up to Alvin Toffler's Future Shock book.
Okay.
And in that book, I write a chapter called Technological Hallucinations. And the chapter is all about what we've been talking about this evening. It's about the future of perception, the future of digital consciousness, simulations, augmented reality in the future. So that should be out at the end of this year.
Great. Great. That is very exciting to hear. Once again, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your vast realm of knowledge and theory with our audience. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you this evening, and look forward to having you on again if you'd like.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Chris. Oh, yeah, man. Anytime. Feel free to reach out. If you could hold the line for just a moment, and we'll be right back with you. While you're online checking out the great work of Grace Scott and Futuristic Now at grayscott.com, as well as on YouTube, make sure to go on by dudesandbeer.com. That is where you can find the Knowledge Vault. We are all about sharing knowledge with people, and whenever we find things like patents of Nikola Tesla, different programs that were declassified by the CIA, even the big JFK file dump that came out from the FBI. All that stuff is there in the Knowledge Vault, folks. Go check it out. It's all downloadable PDFs. Make sure to stop on by HC Universal Network to check out not only Dudes and Beer, but Talking Sound, Yes But Why podcast, and more. Until next time, everybody, please remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and if you can't be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.